Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is my wardrobe malfunction. Welcome to New Friends, and thanks so much to those who joined us last week for our first episode of Season 9 with the fabulous Denise Welsh. We've had such wonderful feedback, which is so lovely to hear. If you really enjoyed it, please do leave us a rating and a review, as apparently it makes a difference, though no one's ever explained what that difference actually is. Anyway, a bit later on, you'll hear another track from our house band duo's new album, Destino. But now on to this week's special guest. You'll probably have seen him trekking through inhospitable terrain and wondered how the hell he's going to get out of it in one piece. Well, he did, and he's even had time to write a new book called Escape from Kabul, though not about his escape in this instance. It's the explorer and best-selling author, Leveson Wood. So, let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. Today, I am absolutely thrilled to be speaking to world-renowned explorer, best-selling author, photographer, and former British paratrooper, Leveson Wood. How are you?
Hello there. I'm very well, thank you.
It's so nice to see you. I have watched all your documentaries when they came out, and then I've rewatched some of them, but I hadn't seen Arabia before, and I watched, kind of binged watched that, and it was just fascinating. And I know we should be talking about clothes, but there's so much more to be talking about. But just let's start with your name, Leveson. It's such a great name. Where did that come from?
Well, it's actually my father's name. He's Leveson Wood, and his dad was Leveson Wood, and his dad and his dad. So I'm actually the fifth Leveson Wood in my family line.
But where did it come from originally?
Well, originally, I think it was back in the sort of mid-19th century, there was a chap called Lord Leveson Gower. He was the Earl of Shrewsbury, I believe, or something like that. And it was the fashion of the day, if you were a peasant farmer, to name your kids after the local aristocrat. So my family, sadly, they don't come from any aristocratic stock, but the family name has certainly stuck, yeah.
It is weird that, because I've written a book, and I was looking back at all that, and all these memories came flooding back. And one of them was a nanny from a family, and she was called Nanny Manners, which wasn't her name. She took the name of her family. And this is only 25 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, what's funny, my dad's been nagging me for grandchildren for a very long time and to carry on that family name. But since I've been on the telly, I've had about 50 people get in touch saying they've named their kids Leveson.
Oh,
really?
Oh, goodness.
So well, there's a few out there.
At least there are a few next generation scampering around. And you had quite a kind of, for want of a different word, a better word, macho upbringing, because your dad was in the army, wasn't he?
And he was, yeah.
Was he quite a tough man? Was he?
He was. I mean, he's mellowed in his old age, but he was in the reserves, and you know, he grew up from very, very working class stock, and my granddad was in the army, so that was very much a big part of my upbringing and consciousness growing up. I kind of knew from about the age of 10 that I was going to become a soldier. And although I think growing up in, you know, a pretty rough part of Stoke-on-Trent was probably one of the reasons I wanted to go and see the world and see what was beyond the confines of North Staffordshire.
And do you think, I mean, how much influence did your mum have on you?
Oh, a lot. I mean, she was a primary school teacher, so I think the value of education was always part of my my childhood. My dad was a geology teacher in high school, and so they both had a huge bearing on my outlook. But certainly, growing up in and around education, that was, you know, the value of reading. So from a very young age, I was fascinated by history and geography and other cultures, purely because there were always books lying around. And even though we could, you know, rarely afford to go on big exotic family holidays, you know, there was always that inspiration was lying around from stories and other people's books.
But you did go to Greece, didn't you? Well, that was one of your first.
Yeah, no, we did. I mean, they sort of, you know, they cobbled together a few quid and ensured that I had at least an insight into the big wide world. And I think that was really where my journey began. It was just like little forays and adventures, and started with, you know, camping holidays in Scotland and Wales, and then we did venture further afield. But I was always fascinated by different ways of life and seeing what was over the next sort of horizon, really.
So you were you always kind of quite outward bound as a teenager, like happier to stay in a tent than in a house?
Oh, yes. No, sort of as a kid, we'd go on these little family holidays to, like I say, Wales, and my dad was always insistent that we'd go and explore the local castles and National Trust sort of places and things like that. So I love being outside, and I was really very lucky in many ways to grow up on the edge of the Peak District, because very easy to go for a little walk, and I did things like the Duke of Edinburgh's Award and that, you know, those early expeditions really sort of set the tone for later on. But, you know, when I was a teenager, we were always off scampering around the woods and out camping and things like that.
Were you a naughty teenager in a typical naughty teenager way, or were you just physically courageous, or did you kind of...
Oh no, I was very much a naughty teenager. I was always getting in trouble.
Do you get pissed and sniff glue, or were you just kind of skinning rabbits?
I stayed away from the glue, thankfully. but no, I was always getting in trouble. I mean, there were a couple of moments as a kid that I got in plenty of mischief. But thankfully, I was always pretty good at school, so I managed to get away with it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we've got three kids, and when our eldest kid was eight, we moved out of London. And specifically because, well, I grew up in the countryside, my husband grew up in the countryside, but it gives you, it's kind of what you learn from nature is so valuable. And my personal opinion is that it's more valuable than living in an urban environment. If and when you have kids, would you want them to grow up in the countryside?
Definitely. I mean, yeah. The value of nature it can't be overstated. I mean, it's something having lived in London now for the best part of 12 years, it's something I very much crave, you know, growing up in the countryside, just being outside, being near to the woods, and it just has a whole bearing on your, not just your personality, but your mental health. And I think whilst I live in London, I'm always trying to escape it and going off on adventures. And I think a lot of that is just craving the natural world. And I think living in a city it's not a very natural way of life, really. And I've certainly come to appreciate that more and more the older I get. So, yeah, no, I think if when I do have a family, it would certainly, I'd like to think it would be not in central London, yeah.
Why do you live in London?
I mean, to be honest, it's been very convenient for me the last sort of few years. Whilst I've been doing a lot of travelling, it's quite nice to just fly, you know, land at Heathrow or Gatwick and then be back at home in 45 minutes rather than having to then do a 2-hour commute down to wherever, Devon or Dorset.
Okay, can I just tell you something?
Go on.
All right, we live in Sussex.
Yeah.
All right. We look out of our house. So it's kind of, we did this room. Unfortunately, it's quite bright. I don't know if you can see.
It's a very nice room as well.
It's a nice room, isn't it? Okay.
Lovely.
So look at that view. You can't see that crazy.
No, that is.
And we are 4 minutes from a train station. All right. And 10 minutes from Gatwick.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
No excuse. That's absolute bollocks that you have. It's more convenient.
But look at this. I'm going to show you. I've got a shop right here. Where's your shop? There's the river.
Literally. Okay. Okay, all right, you win on that one.
But no, I'm going to go and find some trees, don't worry.
So who are your inspirations? I presume David Livingstone and not David Bowie. Who are your...
you know what, one of my biggest inspirations, I have to say, a bit of a cliche, but it is those sort of explorers of yesteryear with lots of big hairy moustaches and things like that. Livingstone, Scott, Shackleton, all of the classics of Victorian and early 20th century exploration, really. Richard Burton actually was my firm favourite. He was a sort of classic Victorian explorer, but very much a polymath. I mean, he spoke 27 languages. He translated the Kama Sutra into English. He got into all sorts of trouble. I mean, he was out as a British sort of Victorian political officer and soldier. He was sort of out there exploring the opium dens of India and off in search of the source of the Nile. And he was very much a kind of one of these archetypal heroes that I kind of looked up to as a kid and read all about, and Wilfred Thesiger and Lawrence of Arabia. Those are the people that really inspired me to go. And I thought, you know what, if they can do it, then what's stopping me, really?
I didn't realise that he had done so much, Burton, because I thought it was Speke who'd found.
Well, he did. I mean, that one is steeped in controversy because, of course, Burton and Speke were on the journey together, and Burton was laid up with malaria, and Speke went and did a bit of a turn on him and went. He said, "I'm just going to have a quick look for the source of the Nile," and then he found Lake Victoria, and then decided to bugger off back to the UK and claim it for his own, whilst leaving Paul Burton in bed. So.
Okay, so that's...
But they have been on the journey for a very long time together. So, but out of the two, I think Burton's my favourite.
But it is extraordinary. It's like you say, you know, you've got your documentary series, which is Walking the Nile. And you were the first person to do that, which is astonishing, absolutely astonishing. But it's kind of like the sort of thing you think, well, someone must have done that before. And you did that, what, how many, like, 9 years ago?
started in 2013, so yeah.
So was that because of kind of warring factions? Why had it not been...
Well, the Nile, you know, the Nile's, it's a very long river that goes through lots of quite difficult countries and terrains. And then up until, you know, the 20th century, it was just... There was no real need to travel its length either on foot or indeed by boats. I mean, there was all the cataracts, the waterfalls, which meant it was unnavigable anyway.
Yeah.
So most people would, if they were going in search of the source of it, they kind of roughly knew it was somewhere in Central Africa. So people would take a boat down to East Africa and then cut inland to try and find it through places like Tanzania and Uganda. There were forays going up the Nile through places like Sudan, but South Sudan hasn't always been, and even to this day is, a very lawless and dangerous and difficult place. And until the invention of anti-malarials, most people, you know, on these journeys of 2-3 years would just drop dead. And then throughout most of the 20th century, the place has been in civil war. So it's just been very, very difficult for people to get through. So, and even when I do it, you know, it did it. It was very, very tricky. And I mean, the civil war was happening then. It was an amazing journey to be a part of. And it sort of enabled me. I mean, I had no idea whether it would be successful or a failure, and certainly had no idea that it would gain the traction that it did in terms of having a TV series and being able to write a book about it. That was never really the intention. It was just going to do a whopping great journey, and feel very lucky that it sort of paid off from that front and has enabled me to carry on doing all sorts of different journeys afterwards.
But did you literally just wait? You left the art because you were in the paratroopers. And you got to the position of captain and then decided to leave. And then did you just kind of wake up and think, okay, am I going to go and get the newspaper? No, actually, I'm going to go and walk the Nile. How did you decide to do that?
Well, I needed some sort of gainful employment. So I was interested in photography and writing anyway. I studied history at university. And... I fancied myself as a bit of a writer and a photographer. I always loved travel, of course, and I've been in far too many gap years to count. But I figured that now was the time to go and really do something and I suppose make a name for myself. I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and that was an opportunity to take some big risks. So I ended up, when I left the paras, me and another mate from the army, we set up a sort of guiding expedition company. So we were taking people on quite wild expeditions, places that we went horse riding to the source of the Oxus River in Afghanistan. We went camel riding across the Sahara. We even took somebody skiing on the Iran-Iraq border. It wasn't long before lots of journalists got in touch, and we had all the big production houses and the channels calling up. So, oh, can you smuggle us into Syria or whatever? So, one thing led to another. It took about 3 years of doing this and using that as a vehicle to do my own photography. And I was writing articles for newspapers and doing the odd bit for Lonely Planet and things like that. So it wasn't quite as simple as wake up and walk the Nile. There was a bit of a five year backstory to it. But really, I knew that at some point I'd have to go and do my own big trip in order to, I suppose, plant that flag, really. And the Nile was always a river that I'd been interested in. I'd read all about it. And so I thought, now is the time, go and do it.
What kind of preparation do you have to do for an expedition like that? I mean, in terms of navigate, I mean, how much of the route do you work out? Do you go to countries before to find?
No, you didn't do a recce. No, it was, I mean, you,
no.
It was more, I mean, it was about 18 months of just trying to fundraise, really. That was the hardest bit, was getting the cash together. Obviously, you need to do a bit of homework in terms of figuring out what paperwork and visas and permits you need. That's all the boring bits. But then you do need an understanding of the local culture and languages and things. But I think the best investment you can have is getting a good guide. And that, for me, was a really important part of it, was making sure that whoever I was with was somebody I could trust and get along with, because you're in each other's pockets literally for weeks, if not months on end. And if you don't get on with somebody, or if you don't trust them, then it's not going to work. So a lot of it was finding decent guides to help me get through.
How do you go about that?
I mean, by that stage, you accrue a sort of quite a wide network of friends and acquaintances particularly from the army, who then go on to do jobs that might be in the UN or as journalists or as security advisors. So it's just a case of sort of casting the net and usually word of mouth referrals, saying, oh, you know, my mate's taxi driver's cousin is, you know, knows this area like the back of his hand. And as a result, you end up walking with this bloke for 4 months.
The one I remember of one of your guides was in Central America. I can't remember which.
Oh, Alberto. Which, yeah, he's a.
And he had no experience. He'd done nothing, and he was a little roly-poly fella. And off he went. I mean, he was incredible.
He's an amazing guy. We were still best of friends, and whenever I go to Mexico, I see him. But no, I mean, he, you know, being, when I say the word guide, it's not necessarily someone who can read a map or needs to, you know, use a compass. It's just somebody who is charming enough to get you out of trouble whenever it comes along, and that's quite often on these trips. And so Alberto, whilst he hadn't really walked anywhere, he's one of those charming blokes I've ever met, and he got us out of lots of very close scrapes.
So what would you do? What if, let's say, you were kind of slapped up against a wall with a gun at the back of your head? How would you get out of that?
Well, I mean, that actually happened to me in South Sudan. We were,
of course,
before I walked the Nile. I had been there before, and we were doing a rafting trip down the River Nile, and we had got all the paperwork in place, but somehow the word hadn't got down to the local militia groups who were, you know, in that particular area. So after five fairly uneventful days, we were floating down the river into the capital, Juba. And just as we were, I don't know, we were probably only a sort of few hours away, we saw this movement on the riverbanks, and there was all these blokes running alongside shouting, and then suddenly somebody started opening fire. They were firing warning shots over our heads, and you know, these guys were clearly meant business, but we couldn't really stop because we were in the middle of a kind of fast flowing river with rocks and rapids. And next thing you know, it was like a scene out of Indiana Jones when all these guys are chasing after us in dugout canoes with spears and things, and they eventually caught up with us, dragged us over to the one side, lined us up against the, you know, the riverbank, and AK-47s in the back of our heads. And it's times like that that you do have to sort of think quickly on your feet. And one piece of advice that I'd always been given whenever traveling in African war zones is always carry a pack of cigarettes, because, you know, they whilst, you know, I'm not a smoker, it turns out that most of these gunmen do like a cigarette. And so I sort of looked at this guy and pulled out a cigarette and offered him a fag, and you could see the cogs turning. He's like, what do I want more? Do I want to shoot you in the head, or do I want a cigarette? And of course, he could have had both, but the moment you make eye contact, you sort of establish a bit of a rapport, and he sort of snuck one himself, and then all of his mates wanted one, and before you know it, we're all laughing and joking, and we're all best friends. So there are, and have been, lots of moments like that, where you just have to sort of keep people on a human level and not let emotions run away, really. It's just kind of, yeah, just eye contact and a big smile sometimes is all it takes.
I mean, having been in the military, all that training, and then you went to Afghanistan, Burundi, Malawi, that must have helped. That must have created a foundation for you, a safety foundation, yeah, to do these more extreme
things. It does. It gives you a sense of a real appreciation of what real risk is, because whilst it's all too easy to get very nervous being around people with guns and war zones and things, actually the vast majority of people aren't out to do any harm. They're, you know, people do tend to look after each other, and it's, I think it's having a sense of optimism, really, is what helps, and keeping everything in perspective and understanding the real risks, because often it's not the gunmen or the...
It's probably some pissed driver.
Well, usually it's car accidents. Yeah. And I've had a fair share of those as well, and that's the real risk. And so it's all well and good worrying about the being eaten by a crocodile, but if you're happy to then jump in a taxi that with somebody who's had a few too many whiskies, then you're kind of missing the point.
So your book, you've written this new book, Escape from Kabul, about the coalition's evacuation. Mm. Why did you decide to do that? Well, let me just wind that back. How long were you in Afghanistan for?
So, I mean, I've been to Afghanistan, what is it, four times, I suppose, over the years, maybe five, but only once with the army. I was there in 2008 on a tour with the parachute regiment. We were fighting in Helmand and Kandahar. But I'd been back a few times since, you know, I was out there trying to pioneer tourism in the northeast. And then on my Himalayas expedition, I walked across the Wakhan corridor. So there was a real affinity for me to the country. And I've always, you know, been looked after very well there. And I've got a lot of very good Afghan friends. So when it all kicked off in August 2021, it was just a real sense of sadness and sort of a bit of shame, actually, that we'd let it come to this. And the fact that we'd, I suppose, in many ways, left the place no better than it started 20 years before. So, and at the time, there was a lot of, you know, not only that feeling amongst the veteran community of being let down, but a bit of an optimism, because our colleagues in the form of interpreters and Afghans that had served alongside us, obviously they were in grave danger at the time from reprisals from the Taliban. And it was actually, whilst the government were mainly on holiday, you know, and it took them a long time to sort of bother to do anything about it. It was actually the veteran community who were all scrambling, as well as the military who were sent out there to go and help. You know, the veteran community really clubbed together to help get their former comrades out. And that really, I thought, was very inspiring. And so I wanted to write a book as a bit of a tribute to all the people that played a part in that, and tell the stories of the Afghans themselves. And so I spent, I mean, it was in many ways, in September last year, I talked about motorcycle accidents. I came off a bike in Greece and broke my leg, which gave me the perfect opportunity to sit down and write this book. So I interviewed lots of people, the soldiers of Tupara, civil servants, loads of Afghans, people who did escape, people who didn't, politicians. I interviewed Dominic Raab, Ben Wallace, Johnny Mercer. And so this book really is the sort of the product of all of those interviews. And it was really, really interesting to sort of get all these different perspectives on this one truth and provide a bit of a historical account of what happened here.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It is the most amazing country. I mean, I don't know it so well, but I spent a lot of time in Pakistan, and which is a country I really love, and I love the people.
Yeah.
And we went up into the Northern Territories, sort of up to the Dosai Plain. I can't remember if you walked across the Dosai Plain. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And then we went then back down to Chitral, and I remember we met Masood before he was killed. And just those people are, they have such nobility and such a grace and such a deep sense of history and their country. I think it's one of the most extraordinary places in the world. And that's kind of your next documentary, isn't it? Walking the length of the border between Pakistan and India.
Yeah, well, I did that last summer. All the way from Leh in Ladakh, you know, through Kashmir, Punjab, and then up the Pakistan side up to Skardu,
Skardu,
it's remarkable, beautiful scenery, and the people there are fantastic. And that was a film for Discovery Channel, so
But it's, I heard, because we went to Skardu, and we went to Gilgit, and we went to Hunza, and it was a long time ago. This must have been about 35 years ago, so almost before you were born. And it was, from what I understand, such a different place, because it's gone through this evolution of being a backwater and then the Taliban, and it's kind of becoming quite a place for tourism. And, you know, my Pakistani friends are sort of like so proud of the fact that in Hunza there's a really nice hotel, and I'm, you know, typical, we don't live there, and you know, progress is fantastic for them, but I have this romantic ideal of
Hunza,
of how it was,
sort of the Shangri-La, wasn't it? I mean, it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen, and I guess at the moment you have a road in there, then everything changes. I mean, for the vast majority of its history, it's been totally isolated particularly during the winter. There was just no way in or out, and now things have changed. I think not just with tourism, but, you know, the Chinese are building all these roads there and the access routes and things like that. So that it is changing a bit.
So, Leveson, we need to talk about clothes.
I just wear khaki. I mean, it's not that, it's pretty straightforward.
I mean, how do you know what to take? What do you... Okay, so let's think. So when you were doing the Arabian Peninsula in Lebanon, it got sodding cold and you were completely ill-prepared. But most of the places you've been to so far, well, actually, no, not the Himalayas, but what do you put in your rucksack? It's such a basic question.
Obviously, it does depend a little bit on the environment and, you know, you have to be prepared to a certain degree. But my rule of thumb is if it's not something you use every day, then it just doesn't get packed, because I just only carry one rucksack, and that's got to carry everything, unless I'm doing a technical thing. But for the most part, it's just a day sack. So you've got to be really sparing with what you put in there. So it's my basics, you know, it's my sort of walking trousers, a shirt, I mean, a jacket. I mean, I'll be honest, I do quite like the idea of practical fashion. I mean, I've been involved with a few brands which have been kind enough to let me design my own clothes, and I've designed jackets and shoes for different companies, and it's been a really fun experience for my part, because I've got the practical experience of knowing what actually works in these places, and so I've been able to hopefully impart some of that into the world of fashion in my own little way. But I like my sort of khaki jackets. You know, a lot of it is inspired by military wear and something that is actually robust and is not just going to tear on the first barbed wire fence that you try and jump over.
Have you taken any tips from the Victorians, or has tech wear evolved so far now that is totally impractical?
I don't really
that's good to hear. So you're not wearing, you wear boxer shorts and not Under Armour then?
More or less. I mean, okay, I might wear Under Armour, but really, I mean, I'm not a big fan of, I think just purely because a lot of the tech wear, it's not as durable as they make out. And actually a good old fashioned sort of canvas jacket is usually a lot better, frankly. So, and it looks a bit cooler as well, doesn't it?
Well, that's, I think that is a side of you. There's a bit of you, Leveson, if you're honest, that's quite vain. I mean, there has to be. You know, you pretend not to give a shit, but I'm pretty sure there is a bit of vanity.
I'm not going to wear a bright blue walking jacket.
No. So, I mean, clothing really must be the least important in a way, because like you say, you just rotate or just wear the same thing
or just pick stuff up along the way. I mean, you know, I quite, yeah. If you're traveling through a country where there's people wear a certain type of clothing, it's for a reason usually, and usually a practical reason. And in Arabia, if I was going across the desert, then you know I'd pick up a shawl or kameez or something appropriate for that environment, and because it works. And there's plenty of places where you don't want to stand out necessarily, and it's better to blend in. And going through Yemen, you kind of have to dress like a Yemeni, otherwise you're going to attract a bit of trouble. So that's been my mantra throughout a lot of my journeys.
Yeah. And so what do you take? Do you take a wash bag?
Yeah, no, I'll take a wash bag, and I'll take the basics. I mean, one item that I do always try and take is at least one clean white linen shirt, which is my sort of staple, because I've often found that even in the deserts or the jungles or wherever, you never know who you're going to bump into, and it's quite handy to have one item of clean clothing that you can look smart. And often it's, you might get dragged in off a police checkpoint to go and have go and meet the local governor, or in Uganda I was invited to go for a dinner with the British ambassador, or in Egypt when I finished my Nile journey, there was a whole press conference waiting for me at the end. So there was things like that, or in the Himalayas, I was invited to go and meet the Dalai Lama. So sometimes the jungle rags just won't do. So the white linen shirt is my staple item of luxury, I think.
But you can't have had a day pack in the Himalayas on your trek.
Yeah, for the most part,
So how did you stay warm at night? I mean, in the day you're walking, so you're keeping yourself.
Well, I had a down jacket. That was my one bit of warm kit, was a down jacket. And then for the most part, I was staying with local families along the way.
Okay. And then headwear, would it be a hat or sunglasses if you could choose one?
No, I did. I mean, choose one. If you're only allowed one, then probably a hat, because, I think keeping the sun over your head is very important. But I do try, I do actually wear sunglasses because I don't want to go blind too early.
Which sunglasses?
I'm a bit of a Ray-Ban stalwart, to be honest. Go for the old Wayfarer classics.
Yeah, always polarized.
Yeah.
So, how many pairs of boots did you get through, for example, walking the length of the Nile?
Well, you know what? I actually only wore one pair of boots for 8 months, and then some silly chap who was a professional podiatrist recommended that when I got to Egypt, I should change my boots for some trainers, because I'd be mainly walking along roads. And I listened to the expert, you see, and it resulted in some of the most horrific blisters I'd have ever had. I should have stuck to my good old fashioned army walking boots. But yeah, no, I mean, if you've got some good boots, then stick to them. It's whatever makes you comfortable. I'm not too prescriptive when it comes to clothing. It's just like, if it works, it works.
Yeah. And do you think generally, is it leather boots or tech boots that work the best?
I've got some good leather boots. They tend to work, although there are some really good brands that are coming out with more sustainable fabrics and things like that now that are just as good, for sure.
Okay. And do you use any apps?
What, for navigation?
For navigation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, generally, you know, Google Earth has definitely got its benefits over paper maps, rather than carrying, you know, lots of maps that fill up your rucksack. I mean, you've got it all at the tip of your fingers. So, Google Maps has been very helpful over the years.
Yeah, I can imagine. And how do you prepare physically? Do you kind of get fit, or do you just allow yourself to get fit along the journey?
I think acclimatization is probably the most important thing, because if you're going to go and walk for 9 months, actually, there's not much preparation you can do. You know, you're not going to walk for an extra 2 months just for the sake of it. I think for me, it was just about taking it easy the first few weeks, getting used to the altitude, getting used to the heat, and breaking yourself in easily. I'd start by walking 5 miles per day or 10 miles per day, and then work it up. And then by the end, I was, you know, I think the most I've done in one day is probably about 65 miles, which is, Christ, wouldn't recommend it, but definitely a long way.
That is a hell of a long way. And then do you have, on these trips, is there one thing, like a sort of comfort blanket, that you would never be without in any given environment?
Probably that white linen shirt, really, just because you never know when it's going to come in handy. I do always, you know, I am a passionate photographer, so I'll always have my Leica camera with me, because that gives me, in many ways, it is a comfort blanket, because everybody likes having their photograph taken, and actually it's a conversation starter, and especially in little villages in the, you know, in the Hindu Kush mountains, or anywhere for that matter, there is that sense of connection, because you can take a photo of the kids and show them, and they love it, and they all want their photo taken, and that I've found is a nice way to sort of meet with local people and sort of ingratiate yourself into the local community. And I always try and, I mean, sometimes you can carry a Polaroid, or actually in this day and age you don't need to, because I can send the image straight from my camera to my phone, and then airdrop it to the kids, because they've all got phones as well.
And then do you like being on your own? Are you a solitary person?
I think generally a bit of both. I mean, I when I'm traveling, I'm rarely on my own, really, because you know, there's always, whether I'm traveling with a local guide or a companion, and then the crew will come in and out every few weeks or whatever, so it's not that I'm really on my own very much when I'm traveling. So when I do come back, I do quite like to be on my own. So I, you know, it's, I think it's like anything, you need a good balance. I do enjoy occasionally, if I'm going to have a holiday, then I'd quite happily just take myself off for a few days on my own and go and sit on a beach and read a book.
I'm with you on that. I mean, the people you've met is astonishing, from, like, as you said, the Dalai Lama to George Clooney and Indigenous tribes. But who's impressed you the most?
Who's impressed me the most? I mean,
either in the way they dress or the way they present themselves or charisma, just someone who really left an instant impression on you.
I mean, I have to say the Dalai Lama was up there, because he's just got this incredible aura of serenity and calm and humour more than anything else. He's just always joking and laughing and giggling like a sort of little schoolboy. But it's so infectious, and he makes you feel so welcome. And I remember just sitting down in his living room, and he comes in, and there's this whole protocol where you offer him a kata, this sort of scarf, and he just waved it away. He's like, oh, don't worry about that, you know, and just gave me a big hug. And it's just very, very, very welcoming. And I think, you know, and the simplicity of his attire in many ways is symbolic of what everything that he stands for. And I quite like that.
And have you had a wardrobe malfunction?
I've had loads of wardrobe
malfunctions. So something where your kit has let you down rather than a...
Well, I can tell you one that's quite extreme. and I got in a bit of trouble for this, so don't tell anyone. But it was... I was at a wedding once in London, and it was just in my final days of being in the army. So this is going back a while now. But it was a military wedding, and I was in my full blues. So it was this, you know, the sort of fancy dress with your medals and all that, and your sort of shiny shoes. And it was in London, and I was on the way home, and I was dropping off a friend in South London, in Lambeth, in a taxi. And I got out of the taxi, my friend had disappeared, and then I turned around, the taxi was already driving off. And so I was like, oh, I mean, I'm near the Patmore Estate. Now, the Patmore Estate is not the place you want to be hanging around. at 3 o'clock in the morning, particularly not wearing what I was wearing. But yeah. There I was. And so I was like, oh, and I had the one thing, I had a sword, because you have your military sword. It was my sandhill sword. So I was like running down, trying to chase this taxi, but my sword was slapping against the side of my leg. And so I wasn't, so I had to like, so I thought, oh, it'd be great. I'll just pull my sword out so it doesn't slap against my leg. So as I was running down the road with my sword out, trying to chase down this taxi, it just so happened that a police armed response van was driving past at the same time. So yeah, you can imagine the scene, can't you? These coppers have just sort of screeched in front of me, lights, you know, guns out. And I was like, oh dear. Luckily, they were all ex-military themselves and they were all pissing themselves laughing. They were like, get in, sir. So, you know, they were like, we can't have you running around this Patmore estate with a sword, which is understandable. So anyway, they dropped me off at home.
So what's next for you that you can tell us about?
Oh, there's lots on the horizon. I'm in the middle of filming a new Channel 4 series, actually, at the moment. So that will be hopefully coming out very soon.
You're in the middle of filming it now, so that can't be...
It's not one expedition, that's all I can say. It's sort of it's a series of different things, yeah. Slightly different to some of the stuff I've done before, but yeah, hopefully a worthwhile theme behind it all. So
yeah. And then what would you say is, because the world is getting smaller and smaller, where would you say the last frontier is? Apart from our own minds.
Well, I'm gonna say. I think it's that interface between our minds and the world's wild places, of which the indigenous communities of the world are very much the guardians and the gatekeepers. So I think, you know, those are the places we should be focusing on to protect. And rather than just looking at it from a tourism perspective, it's like, what can we all do to help preserve the wild places of the world and places like the Amazon and so on. So that's kind of been the focus of my work in the last couple of years, and I think we'll probably continue to do so, yeah.
But is there anywhere in the world that hasn't really been discovered?
Depends on what you mean. I mean,
extensively travelled through.
There's definitely parts of Papua New Guinea that are very... very rarely visited, and again parts of the Amazon that are still very much off most people's routes. But it comes in waves, doesn't it? I mean, you have to look at the news and see how disasters can strike, and suddenly a place is you can't even go there for 10 years. So that's kind of the world we live in.
A friend of mine called Rosie Clayton, who was one of the first, I think she was the first woman to walk to unaided to across Antarctica to the South Pole, and she was telling me about this desert in China.
Okay, Taklamakan Desert, perhaps.
Could be, and it's like it's so arduous, so no one's ever walked across it. Of course, you would know. Yeah, that must be it. That must be hell walking across.
Well,
desert.
I'm sure it is. If you can even get into China these days.
Yeah. Okay, so your birthday suit is the one thing that you love wearing. So you come back, you're covered in sand, you look like shit, and then is there something you put on, you think, okay, I'm back, here we go.
Oh, I'm a bit of a lazy dresser in London, to be honest, but I think if it's a special occasion, I do quite like, I mean, I've got an excellent sort of collection of fancy dress items around the world. I mean, I had my 40th birthday last year, and it was sort of a slightly mad theme of just sort of whatever you can drag out from your travel chest. And so I've got some very shiny things from Kashmir and the like, and I've got some very nice Bhutanese dancing shoes.
Have you travelled extensively through Bhutan?
I've been once, yeah. I've only been once. Spent a couple of weeks there. It was beautiful, yeah.
So, Leveson, if you weren't kind of scampering all over the world, what would you be doing? Because I heard somewhere that you were opening a place in America somewhere.
Ooh. Yeah, no, I have actually. So this was my slightly unhinged lockdown COVID project. Was I was out in the States a couple of years ago and did a bit of a road trip around the American Southwest and just fell in love with Colorado. And there's a little known national park there called the Great Sand Dunes. Which is exactly what it says on the tin.
I'm literally writing that down.
No, Great Sand Dunes National Park, and it is. It's got some of the highest sand dunes in the world. It's got the highest sand dunes in the Western Hemisphere. It's like a mini desert.
In Colorado,
buffered up against the Rocky Mountains. It looks like the Sahara. Honestly, it's beautiful. And you've got every environment. You've got sand dunes, snow-capped mountains, pine forests, free-roaming bison, elk, all that stuff, all in one place. And it's magical.
Amazing.
So I decided I needed to sort of spend more time here. So I got a bunch of friends and we bought a patch of desert. So I've got 320 acres of pristine high altitude desert right next to a national park. And I'm sort of setting up a luxury sort of almost African style safari camp for people to stay in for groups. So if you've got a bunch of friends and you want to come and do some stargazing or photography or some yoga or whatever it is you want to do, you can come and stay in my little camp out there.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and then your book.
Yes.
Is out now, isn't it? And that is Escape from Kabul, a really fascinating read and something we should all be informed about.
Thank you so much.
All right, Leveson. Well, I've banged on, you've banged on for nearly an hour now, so I think it's time for us to say goodbye and so much luck with your book and with Colorado and your next adventure.
Thank you, Susanna. Cheers.
Thanks, Leveson. What an impressive and talented guy and so bloody brave. Loved him. Speaking of impressive and talented, this is Ondas by Duo. Amazing. You can buy Duo's new album, Destino, by going to duoguitarmusic.com and find the band on their socials at Duo Guitar Music. And you can find Leveson at levesonwood.com, at levesonwood on Insta, levesonwood on Twitter, levesonwood official on Facebook, and of course, get his new book, Escape from Kabul, at all good bookshops. Finally, you can find us at My Ward Mal on our socials, on our website at mywardmal.com, and of course, subscribe and rate and review us on your chosen podcast platform. That's it. Thanks so much again to Leveson, to Duo, and of course, to you guys for listening. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.